Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today we talk with a young woman who's built a culinary empire in Australia and is now making her bid for the American market. She is Donna Hay, the cookbook author who is credited with saving an entire generation of young Australians from fast food. Donna's food is fresh, quick, and I should tell you, very good. She's joining us to share tips from her latest book. It's called Off the Shelf, Cooking from the Pantry. Kitchen designer Deborah Krasner has the scoop on what they never tell us about nonstick cookware. We get an insider's take on TV's most over-the-top food show, Iron Chef. Reporter Scott Haas is in the kitchen with Iron Chef Morimoto. Grilling expert John Willoughby has the final word on which is really better, gas or charcoal. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are ready to get things started. They write the road food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, most of the time when we think of Tucson, we think of Mexican food because Tucson is a great place to eat real Mexican food. However, a person has to have breakfast. And the great place to eat breakfast in Tucson is a place called Gus Ballen's Restaurant. It's a simple-looking coffee shop, but when you walk in, if it's early in the morning, your nose will tell you that this is a very special place because there will be gigantic warm cinnamon rolls on virtually every table and at every place at the counter. This is the place to eat the great cinnamon rolls of the Southwest.
All right, let me tell you something about Michael. And that is, Michael has never eaten anything in his life that he hasn't first taken a picture of with his camera. And people think that he's demented because when he goes into a restaurant, he...
And who's to say I'm not?
Right, and who's to say you're not, exactly. Pulls out his now digital camera and spends 10 minutes futzing around looking, you know, through the lens.
Jane, I'm not futzing. I'm adjusting things.
You're adjusting the lens while this food is growing cold. Well, at Gus Ballen's, the cinnamon roll was so delicious that every picture Michael has of the cinnamon roll has my hand in the frame pulling hunks of it out because I was not going to sit there and let this masterpiece cool down to room temperature before Michael got his lens adjusted.
Yes, I have action shots of the cinnamon roll.
Actually, the waitress was quite taken with Michael and his camera. She kept coming over and say, "You into pictures, hon?" And Michael would just ask for another cinnamon roll to answer her question.
Now you guys really get into cinnamon rolls. So what?
Yes.
Is this one extraordinary in any
particular? Well, big is better. Big is better.
Yeah, okay.
This cinnamon roll is approximately the size of, well, imagine a six-pack of beer and say half the size of a good six-pack of beer. That is the size of this cinnamon roll. It's that tall. I mean, it's as tall as a 12-ounce can of beer and as big as two or three cans of beer. It's warm. It is veined with lots of cinnamon, lots of sugar, and you can either pull at it with your hands or cut it with a knife and fork.
The best thing also about Gus Ballen's is it opens very early in the morning. Michael, do you remember what time?
Very early.
Like 4 a.m. or something. And since Michael and I are always on Eastern time when we're out west, by, you know, 5 a.m., we're starving and we're absolutely, you know, dying for something to eat. So we stand outside Gus Ballen's and wait for it to open. And Michael just stands there with his camera poised waiting for the cinnamon rolls to come out of the oven.
And by the way, I also happen to have an entire repertoire of pie pictures that I've taken at lunch at Gus Ballen's restaurant. The pie repertoire in this place is staggering. I mean, there are more kinds of pie every day at lunch, and they're baked there every morning than I can count. At least 18 or 20 different kinds of pie every day at lunch.
Well, is there a real Gus Ballen behind the scenes?
Gus Ballen's actually goes way back. I think it's from the 1950s. The current proprietor is a gentleman named Frank Fling, who has kept Gus Ballen's exactly the way it's always been, according to all of the reports that we've heard from old Tucsonians.
And Tucson is a place where a lot of snowbirds go in the winter, and you get a lot of sort of out-of-towners coming into Tucson, but Gus Balance is one of the few places where the locals really eat in Tucson.
Well, I'm now in sugar shock as you describe all of this. Any protein on the menu that you think is exceptional?
They have excellent bacon, and the eggs that you get, if you get like fried eggs, they come swimming in butter. So there, how's that?
Another Jana Michael Stern health food tip for your, for the Cardiology Association of America.
Oh, you did it again. Okay, guys. Goodbye.
Okay.
See you in Tucson.
Keep healthy.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander through the world with me. Any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. Now, every week you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store. I've got a collection of food finds. These are foods I've tasted and liked, and there's a flock of new things, including the first olive oil I've run across from New Zealand. It's peppery, and it smells like fresh-cut grass, and it happens to be organic. Find it all at splendidtable.org. Deborah Krasner is a kitchen designer who loves to find out how things work and find ways to make our kitchens more fun to be in. She's told us how to compost with a worm farm under the sink and how to change countertop heights just by stacking cutting boards. Deborah, welcome back.
I'm glad to be here.
So what's on your mind?
Polytetrafluoroethylene.
It sounds like something that goes into a car engine, lady. What is it?
It is the slipperiest stuff in the world. It's called PTFE in the trade, and it's what makes your nonstick coating on pans.
That's the stuff that is on the nonstick pan.
That's the stuff. It comes sometimes, it has various hardeners in it, and each company has a different proprietary formula. Two of the most well-known ones are Autograph, which is made by DuPont, and Excalibur, which is made by Whitfer. But they're also sold under the names of Teflon, Silverstone, Silverstone Select, Silverstone Extra, Xylan Plus, and Xylan Eterna.
My good. All right. So we're talking here nonstick pans. Are you saying then that essentially all this stuff, in spite of all the names and all the claims, is the same?
Basically, it's all based on PTFE.
PTFE, okay.
But there are big differences. For instance, some companies do two or three coatings, which is, of course, much more durable than if you just do one coat. Also, what the coating is applied to makes an enormous difference. Pans that are heavy pans, particularly heavy on the bottom pans, are going to have a more durable nonstick coating no matter how many layers they are, because it has more insulation between the heat and the coating. Then what the pans are made of affects how well the coating behaves and performs. If the coating is bonded to aluminum, that's good because aluminum can really grip it, even hard anodized aluminum. Whereas when a coating is bonded to stainless steel, it's a little bit harder for the stainless steel to hold on to it.
But the big problem with these nonstick pans is often the fact that that nonstick stuff comes off and eat flakes. Or as a friend of mine says, it looks like you think you put too much pepper in your food, but you didn't.
I know, it's disgusting. The good news is that stuff is supposed to just go right through you without making you ill.
Oh, thanks.
On the other hand, yeah, don't go there. If it starts flaking, throw it out. The short answer to all of this, how do you choose a nonstick pan or what brand should you buy, is essentially the best brands, the brands that you think are going to be the best for uncoated cookware, turn out to be the best for coated cookware, too. So if you're a fan of Calphalon or Allclad or Le Creuset, they make fabulous nonstick pans. If you're interested in spending less money and you want a very good nonstick pan, you can look at pans by Berndes, which is a German company, or pans that are made by the Meyer Corporation and sold under the names of Circulon, Anilon, and Steelon. All of those pans
are
very good pans. Yeah, well, the Lons.
The Lons.
So essentially, you want to get a nonstick pan and you want to treat it gently. Now I want to tell you how to do that. First of all, only use wood or plastic as a utensil. You don't want to scratch that precious surface that you just spent a lot of money on.
Uh-huh.
Second of all, and this is something most people don't know, never use a cooking oil spray that comes from an aerosol can on a nonstick pan.
Oh!
Like Pam. Because it has lecithin in it, and the lecithin makes this sticky residue on the nonstick, and it's dead. It just will never release well again, although you can sometimes save the pan by pouring in some alcohol, like vodka or gin, and washing it with that.
So it'll make it stick. That's
right.
Really interesting.
Right.
Shouldn't be using that stuff anyway. Who wants all that stuff?
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you want to spray, put a little olive oil in one of those pump spray things and spray it yourself. And then you won't have a problem.
Okay, so don't use anything abrasive on it.
Right. And don't use oil spray.
Right.
And then never put a nonstick pan in a dishwasher, because dishwashing detergent can damage the nonstick.
All right.
Protect a pan surface when you put it away in the cupboard. If you have to stack pans, use paper towels in between to protect that nonstick surface. And finally, you have to be sensible. Now, this is sort of delicate. Let me see. One of the best ways to cook, as I think most people know, is to preheat a pan before you put any fat in it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're using a nonstick pan, there are safety issues when the pan gets very, very hot, between 500 and 600 degrees, and you know how hot that is. Your oven doesn't even usually go that hot.
Mm-hmm.
You can heat that nonstick surface so much that it can emit fumes that can kill a canary, should you have a canary in the kitchen. What that means is that there are airborne, not very good to breathe fumes if you let that pan get much, much hotter than it would ever need to be for frying or cooking in any way. Now, there have been no recorded instances of any human being getting sick from those fumes except in industrial situations. That is, it's so rare as to be unknown in a domestic situation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just something that you should keep in the back of your mind to be careful about, but it's not an ever-present danger. So first rule of thumb is turn on the exhaust fan. Second rule of thumb is stand by your pan. I feel like Tammy Wynette. Don't turn on the pan and walk over and make a phone call.
Uh-huh.
Stay next to it. As it's hot enough, put in your food and turn the heat down, and you'll be fine.
Okay, we will not overheat our pans. Hey, thanks, Deborah.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Deborah Krasner designs kitchens across the country from her studio in Vermont. She is author of Kitchens for Cooks. Coming up, great fast food from Australia's newest culinary wizard. In the kitchen with an iron chef, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. When it comes to food, we have a sister country. It's Australia. We're both about the same age. We've both been formed mostly by people from other places, and we've both had an explosion of interest in food.
Well, one of Australia's reigning experts of the kitchen is Donna Hay. She's created a culinary empire. Her food's appealingly modern, simple dishes with style and lots of flavor. Her new book is called Off the Shelf, Cooking from the Pantry. Donna Hay, I have to tell you, I am really intrigued by this book.
Thank you.
There's one section that was a new idea, I think, and it's going to be a new idea for a lot of Americans because we don't think in these terms. It's a section on pastes. Could you explain what you mean?
Well, see, this chapter came about because I am a paste and condiment collector, and I had a pantry in the back of my fridge that was the graveyard of the pastes and condiments. There was stuff there that there was small bottles that were quite expensive. I'd never used them. I could never find the recipe I'd bought that went with the paste or the condiment. And so I decided to go through and just like you do your wardrobe, I just started throwing them out in a frenzy. But then I think they play a really important part in cooking and in cooking a quick meal, a meal that when you get home it could be 7 o'clock at night, and you want something that's full of flavor and fresh but easy to achieve as well.
So, Donna, give me an example of one of the pastes that you're talking about.
Well, I think people think about mustard as a sandwich filling or a spread, something to give their roast beef sandwich a bit of a lift. But next time you're stuffing a piece of lamb, like a lamb shoulder or a boned lamb leg, add lots of Dijon or whole grain mustard to the stuffing, with just a touch of honey as well to round it out, because I like lamb with a little bit of honey, and really make a really intense mustard-flavored stuffing, and then you roast the lamb, and the flavor just goes all the way through. It's sensational. It's one of my favorites. Actually, it's one of the girls' favorites in the studio. They made me cook it about four or five times. They kept telling me it wasn't quite right, and I didn't cotton on right until the end that they were actually just wanted it for lunch for a week.
What about green curry paste?
Green curry paste, it's great to have such intense flavor standbys. You can make a simple green curry sauce for a piece of fish or a grilled chicken breast just by frying off that curry paste, adding a little bit of chicken stock maybe, or some water if you don't have stock at hand, and a little bit of coconut milk or coconut cream. Let that simmer. If you have any kaffir lime leaves, either dried or fresh, just shred them up really finely and add them to that. That makes the dish an absolute sensation. And you can pour that over a chicken breast, some beef, you know, just a grilled steak. It makes a really lovely intense sauce. And I like to serve that actually with a bed of crunchy potatoes or crunchy sweet potato. It's really lovely, and that the sauce just coats over the meat, and it's lovely with the vegetables.
What about miso paste? I think a lot of people get puzzled by it. How do you like to use it?
Well, I find miso paste one of the easiest, because you can make a simple soup from it, or you can enrich a stock, or it's just that extra boost of flavor, and it's not as salty as adding some other sort of flavor intensifiers.
So not fantastic. Like a bouillon cube, essentially.
No, I was trying not to say that, but yeah, it is. It's not like adding one of those nasty cubes. And it's a more rounded flavor as well, miso paste, which comes in white and red. The white is a little bit more delicate, and that's what, miso soup is based on, the white miso. Mm-hmm. But the red is more gutsy, and if you need to add extra flavor to, a veal, beef or lamb sort of simmering casserole or something like that, then the red miso paste is great. The white miso paste is fantastic with fish and chicken. And you can actually mix it with a few things, like a little bit of oil or even some coconut cream or some yogurt, and use it as a marinade.
Mm.
We've got a great recipe for miso-crusted salmon. You just combine white miso paste with a little tahini, which is ground sesame seed paste, some sugar and some water. The sugar just balances the salt that's in the miso paste, so just a pinch of sugar, and you just grill that, and it makes a lovely crust. And the miso is so nutty, and with the tahini, it really combines with that to bring out a really earthy, nutty flavor. It's really lovely.
This sounds wonderful. The Asian chili pastes, a lot of people just like to smear them over things and then grill them. Any other thoughts about what to do with it?
Well, I think that the Asian chili paste, something that you have to do is put it on the tip of your tongue before you cook with it, because there's so many different varieties when you go and look for an Asian chili paste. But it's really lovely with some fresh herbs through it, just to pick it up a little bit, like some coriander or some basil or even just some parsley. If you fold that through the chili paste, it'll really sort of bring it up. And that's what you can then spread on the outside of some fish or chicken or even some beef before you grill it, which is lovely.
I just flipped through the book and I noticed you have a chili fish with sweet lemon salad.
I know, and you know what? That's one of my favorites, Lynn. It's great. The sweet lemon salad, the chili fish is basically what I explained before with the chili paste and the herbs through it, grilled in the fish. But any sort of fish served with this sweet lemon salad is fantastic. You just take the rind and the pith off a lemon using a paring knife.
Yeah.
So cut one end off the lemon first so it stands up flat, if you know what I mean, because mm-hmm. you want a flat surface sitting on your chopping board so the lemon doesn't slip. So cut one end off, stand it up on the chopping board, and then use your paring knife. You need to take all the white pith off because that's the bitter part. And what you're left with is just the flesh of the lemon. And you chop that up and you add sugar and herbs like more coriander and mint and even a little bit of mild red chili. And the sugar brings out the juices in the lemon and it cuts through the acid, but it's really refreshing to serve with some grilled or barbecued fish. With spring coming up, I'm sure we're all going to start heading outdoors. It's a fantastic salad with fish.
Mm. That's a Donna Hay recipe if I ever heard one. Hey, Donna, thank you.
Thank you.
Donna Hay is author of Off the Shelf Cooking from the Pantry. You can get a couple of her recipes, including the miso crusted salmon, on our website. SplendidTable.org. If you watch the Food Network, you know Iron Chef, the Japanese show that's all about culinary gladiators battling for God and country, complete with music, judges doing thumbs up or thumbs down, and narration worthy of a Super Bowl game. Well, Iron Chef Morimoto is the champ of Japanese food, and he's opened his own place in Philadelphia, called appropriately enough, Morimoto. Well, our hungry reporter Scott Haas has managed to get into his kitchen.
Iron Chef. The words alone strike fear in the hearts of cooks and chefs around the globe. I'm in Philadelphia now. I've caught up with Chef Morimoto. Silver Iron Chef, master of the kitchen, and he's here to open his first restaurant. He's worked as a chef in other restaurants throughout the country, like Nobu in Manhattan, but this is his first enterprise where he is in total control. Chef Morimoto is said to be one of the world's great chefs working with raw fish, also known as sushi. And I'm here to find out what are his secrets. What does he do to create great sushi? The chef's arriving. He's now stepping toward us. The cooks are getting out of his way. He's clapped his hands, and this could be a signal to begin.
Pleased to meet you. I'm Scott Haas. They say that you're one of the world's great sushi chefs. What do you do that's different?
A lot of people asking me, you know, how long did I, you know, it's taking to become a master chef. So my answer always the same thing. I'm still learning. Lifetime. It's a very difficult job.
What are some of the most important simple things that I have to do for sushi?
So you should make the good rice.
Uh-huh.
That's all. And you have to choose fresh fish. Only two things.
Fresh fish and good rice. Well, that seems pretty easy. Here's what I want. I wonder if I could watch you work. Can I watch you work?
Sure.
Okay, that's what I want to do. Chef Morimoto is taking out some very large, beautiful knives and placing them on his counter here. There's three enormous knives. And he's taking them out of a leather case. Reminds me of a billiards player. So what is that? What kind of root is it? That's real wasabi.
Yes. And this is a shark fin grater for only wasabi.
And he's put out a large white plate. What is that? What's that?
This is a Japanese vegetable, special we call udon.
He's cutting the Japanese vegetable into paper-thin slices.
It's okay. Okay.
We'll have a microphone. We'll have a microphone sushi here.
No. I'm sorry. I'm not okay.
I'm sorry.
I think I've spoiled it here. I don't think he's forgiven me for slamming into his knife with the microphone. Now, that's some kind of a sauce? Soy sauce dressing. He's moving very fast. Spread it with some wasabi. And now he's slicing the tuna. And he's got two knives here. Beautiful paper-thin slices of tuna. It's like watching an artist, really. So he's created on the plate almost, looks almost like flowers. There's a tuna flower, hamachi flower, the raw Japanese vegetable, and it's on top of a marinade. And then there's these, what's that you're sprinkling on?
The Japanese pepper, just cut up.
That's a very beautiful plate. Looks like butterflies have landed there. Do you always move this fast?
I move fast. If you're not here, I'm more fast.
I'm sorry. I got in your way last time. I'm very sorry about that. So, you know, sushi is very popular now. Did I wreck your knife? Did I damage your knife?
I think so.
You do? I'm very sorry.
That's okay. Huh?
Are you having fun doing this?
Yes, I am. I'm kind of crazy, though. When I hold the knife, yeah. And when I, you know, see the customer in front of me, and so I'm going to do myself. It's my world.
I understand.
And then, so I am kind of crazy, though.
Well, you're very efficient, though. You're very fast. It's focused. You're very focused. It's like watching someone in their own world, you know?
During the Iron Chef show, I was shaking.
Now, why were you shaking?
I am drunk. Excited, very excited.
Yeah. And then, you know...
How long did you do that for?
2 years.
Two?
Yeah, but I am still the President Iron Chef.
Uh-huh.
But that's enough. You know, I have another life.
You have another life?
Yeah, that was good, but that was good experience, but...
That was then, this is now.
Right.
Tetsujin Morimoto Masala!
It's the Iron Chef. Morimoto is the one to survive, and that's what it was in this battle, survival.
Well, I wanted to thank you for taking your time, and again, I'm very sorry about the knife and the microphone.
Just joking, bud.
All right, well, thank you again.
Morimoto Restaurant is in Philadelphia. Our intrepid reporter Scott Haas and his microphone reside in Boston. John Willoughby wears more hats than most food pros do. He's executive editor of Gourmet Magazine, an award-winning food writer, and co-author with his pal Chris Slazinger of a clutch of books on grilling. Now, he stops by often to talk about whichever hat he happens to be wearing at the moment. John, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Grilling time is upon us. And the huge question, and you're the expert on this, which really is better, the gas grill or the grill, you know, with the charcoal?
Well, I definitely have an opinion on that. And I think, for me, there's no comparison. Charcoal grill is so much better. The gas grill is very convenient, and I don't mean to disparage anybody who uses them. I use them myself when I'm really in a hurry. But to me, it's the difference between cooking in a microwave versus cooking in the oven. The microwave is fast and convenient, but it's not satisfying, and you don't get the same flavor. And that, I think, is true also of charcoal versus gas. And let me start with the first thing that's most important for me is it's fun to build a fire and to worry about the fire and to mess around with the fire. I mean, basically, when you're grilling with charcoal, you're playing with fire. And there's nothing that's much more fun than that. It makes it the most interactive, the most involving cooking that you can do. And for me, that's a large part of the attraction. And it does take some time to build a fire. But it really isn't that much more time-consuming than gas grilling, because you're supposed to let those gas grills warm up for 10 to 15 minutes before you grill.
Mm-hmm.
And if you use the right kind of fire starter, your charcoal is going to be ready in 25 minutes. So we're talking 10 more minutes. And what you get out of it is the fun of really interacting with the fire and being part of the process, which I think is unbeatable. The second part of it is you also get better flavor. Because what creates that real grilled flavor that we all love is not so much the smoke, unless you're smoke roasting with the cover down, but when just grilling on an open grill, it's the interaction of a very high heat with the outside of the food. And very few gas grills can get as hot as a charcoal fire. A good charcoal fire can be as hot as 2,000 degrees, and you simply can't get that hot on a gas grill. So you don't have the heat. And you also, the difference between the two fuels, one difference is gas is what they call a wet fuel. When you burn gas, it produces carbon dioxide and water vapor. So you're not, it just, you can't get as good a sear with it as you can with charcoal, which produces no water at all. It's a very dry heat. So I think you get a better flavor and you have more fun.
You mentioned starting the fire. How do you like to start a charcoal fire?
I like to use one of the simplest and most effective tools ever devised by humanity. It's called a chimney starter. And what it is, it's just a round cylinder. I'm sure you've seen them. A round metal cylinder with a handle on it, and it's got a little grid down at the bottom. You put some newspaper underneath it. You put the charcoal in the cylinder on top of the newspaper. You light the newspaper. The flames sweep up through the charcoal, and in literally 7 minutes, if you're using the right kind of charcoal, your charcoal is lit and ready to go.
So what's
it
your
always works.
What's your take on lighter fluid then?
Lighter fluid is good too, actually. I think it's got kind of a bad rap because if you don't let it burn off completely, it's going to flavor the food. But if you wait until all the coals are covered with gray ash, which you should do anyway before you start grilling, you're not going to have any taste from the lighter fluid. So it's actually not, if you're careful with it and you let the coals get all lit, it's not a bad way to start a fire. It's not as fast as the chimney method, actually, though. So.
Uh-huh. What's your feeling about the wood charcoal versus the commercial briquettes?
Well, briquettes aren't bad. You can make a good hot fire with them. You should never use the kind of briquettes that have lighter fluid in them, because the lighter fluid never really burns off in those. So those, I don't remember the brand names, but the ones that are, mm-hmm. you know, you light the bag and the whole thing lights, I wouldn't use those. But the standard charcoal briquettes are fine, but they're not as good as hardwood charcoal. And the reason is, briquettes are basically powdered charcoal that's been put with binders and starters. So you've got chemicals in there, and they don't light as fast and they don't burn as cleanly, because hardwood charcoal is simply pure carbon or almost pure carbon, which means it lights better, it burns hotter, it burns cleaner, and it's more responsive to oxygen. So if you're trying to manipulate the level of your fire by opening and closing little vents, it's going to work a lot better there too.
Hey, John, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and co-author with Chris Slazinger of License to Grill. You can get his recipe for rosemary grilled New York strip with smoked eggplant relish. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly food challenge. Now, this week's question is, what's the relationship between a spice trader and a garbler, that is someone who relays information in a confused way? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment, and that number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's food question. Now, the question was, what's the link between a spice trader and a garbler? That means someone who garbles their words or confuses information. Well, the link is that garble really meant originally a sieve. And centuries ago, in the Mediterranean spice trade, a garbler was a person who sifted spices. They sifted out all the rubbish, the twigs and the bugs and all that kind of thing, from the spices. And that rubbish was the garble. And yes, I know, I am probably the only person in the entire country who finds this fascinating. Are opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Lorena on the line. So, Lorena, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. Me and my husband, we love polenta, but we only make it one of two ways. I either make it kind of thick and then roll it out into a roll, like a little log, and then cut it into patties and serve it with marinara sauce.
Right.
And then my husband kind of makes it creamy, like cream of wheat almost, and
right.
adds cheddar cheese to it that way. But that's basically all we do with it, and I know there's got to be other ways to eat it.
Oh, boy. Do we have a half hour? No, this is the stuff my family always made polenta. In fact, when my mother married my stepfather, the first argument they ever had was in which direction to stir the polenta. And it was a battle royal in the kitchen. Well, in Italy, it's served in a lot of ways. First of all, your marinara sauce. Anything you would put on pasta, you can put on polenta. And one thing that's done is you can make like a polenta lasagna.
Mm-hmm.
You can take either the hot, creamy polenta or the polenta like yours that's sliced, and you do layers. So you do something like the marinara sauce that you make, mozzarella, some parmigiano, maybe some sliced salami, and you layer that in a casserole, and then you top it with lots of cheese and lots of tomato sauce, and you bake it. But one of my favorite ways of eating it, it's a farmer's mountain breakfast. And you take that hot polenta and you top it with honey and ricotta cheese and cinnamon.
Oh.
It is out of this world. It is like a dessert, but it's so tasty. And then another way that it's done is make it with some chicken broth. Like instead of the water, use half chicken broth and half water. And then take a really nice piece of blue cheese, put that on the plate, just a piece maybe that's 2 inches by 4 inches, okay?
Okay.
Next to that, put a big spoonful of mascarpone cheese, you know, that big, fatty, delicious, creamy cheese.
Yeah, that stuff you can buy like in the dairy section.
That's right. And then spoon over that the hot cream of wheat style polenta that your husband has.
Uh-huh.
And top it with some butter that you've browned. You just cook melted butter until it turns brown.
Oh, wow.
And sprinkle that just with some black pepper and a little salt, and you are in seventh heaven. You can do sautéed portobello mushrooms on top of it. You can take butternut squash and brown it in a skillet with onion and garlic. Add a little tomato and balsamic vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute, and then simmer that with some broth until the chunks of butternut squash are tender. That's an old mountain dish from Emilia Romagna, and you put that over the polenta.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yes, it's a ton of stuff you can do. And if you want any more ideas, you can look at Italian cookbooks, especially anything coming out of northern or central Italy. So anything about Tuscany, anything about Emilia-Romagna, Lombardia, the Veneto.
Okay, that sounds great. I'm going to try the farmer's breakfast dish.
It's
I
delicious.
Think right away.
Yeah, doesn't it's just the kind of thing when, especially on a wintry night, a cold, snowy night, it's just incredible.
Oh, so thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for a great question. You take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We've got Jason calling. Hey, Jason, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I was listening to your show last week, and just as a side note, you mentioned something about thimble cheese, and you were wondering if it really existed.
Yeah.
With cheese made from human milk.
Uh-huh.
I was a cheese seller at Zingerman's for 2 years, and in our little circle, we knew that to be true. It was outlawed, apparently, for sort of moral implications or something like that. That's the word we got.
Oh, dear.
But I'm calling because I was wondering if, I know a lot about cheese. I don't know anything about beer.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to find a beer to pair with cheese called Valdeón, which is a Spanish blue cheese. It's really beautiful. It's wrapped in chestnut leaves, and it's got a great presentation and a really complex, kind of strong taste, but it's not funky like a lot of strong cheeses. I think it's one of the top five cheeses in the world.
Really?
I've tasted. Yeah, it's really
I don't
great.
Think
it's,
I've had it. Valdeón.
Yeah, it's similar to Cabrales, which is one of Spain's premier cheeses. Cabrales is a mix of cows and goats in ewe's milk, and Valdeón is primarily cow's milk. Sometimes it has some goat's milk in it, depending on what the farmer has available. But it's kind of like Cabrales. Can you hear my 2-year-old?
Yep.
we're catching a dog that's in our it's strayed into our backyard, and he.
Offer him some Valdeón cheese. He'll probably come in 2 seconds.
That's right.
So you want to know what beer might work with a blue cheese that has a real strong, distinctive blue cheese character, but it's not funky.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, you're talking to somebody who doesn't drink a lot of beer.
Yeah.
But we've had a lot of beer experts on the show.
Right. That's why I'm calling you.
Yeah.
Well, I know a lot of people who know a lot about cheese, and I know a lot of people who know a lot about beer. But I don't know anybody who knows about both.
Yeah. You know, Stephen Beaumont, who's someone we have on often, has a book, and I think it's called The Bold Beers of the World. Oh, gosh, I'm not going to remember this.
Okay. But it's Stephen
the
Beaumont.
The premium, though. Here it is, from a little voice in my ear, The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide by Stephen Beaumont. And the great thing about it is he does talk about beer and food pairing. But this is what comes to me off the top of my head.
Okay.
If there are beers I have some sense of, they're Belgian beers.
Okay.
And there are a couple of Belgian beers. What I'm thinking of with something that is salty and robust and rich, like what you seem to be describing.
Yes.
I'm thinking I would like a cheese that's big, rather a beer that's big and robust and perhaps with a hint of underlying sweetness to it, because that'll work beautifully with the saltiness.
Yeah.
And what comes to mind is there are Belgian Abbey beers that have this quality. They're like drinking a meal. They're really lush. Westmalle.
Uh-huh.
Westmalle, I think, okay. Is the spelling. Triple, as in triple, you know, the T-R-I-P-L-E, is one that comes to mind. And I'd say anything that's from Belgium that has the word Abbey on the label, I'm very serious, that will probably have this characteristic.
Okay, great.
So think about that, but take a look.
The beer that you described is like the wine that I drink with it. But I didn't know what to find, how I would find that in a beer. But the way you described it with that undertone of sweetness as well and all that.
So this is great. Then this hopefully will work.
Oh, good. Well,
hey,
thanks a lot.
You're welcome. And thanks for introducing us to a cheese that probably a lot of us haven't heard of.
Oh, Valdeón. It's a great cheese, yeah.
Okay, Jason.
Take care. Bye.
Goodbye. All right. Let's see who's up. We've got Amy calling. So, Amy, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. First of all, I want to say how much I enjoy your show.
Hey, thank you.
I'm from Scottsdale, Arizona, and every Saturday morning I like to go to the local organic farmer's market.
Uh-huh.
And I came across a beautiful bunch of baby beets intact with beautiful green leaves. And I'm wondering if you have any good ideas how to prepare both the leaves and the beets.
Okay, baby beets. What color are they?
They're very deep red, and they're about twice the size of radishes, actually.
Oh, that sounds so good. You know, one of the things to do, because these baby beets can have a very, you know, sort of sweet, special flavor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd cook them.
Oh, really?
No. You know, all right, I'm going to make this up. You ready?
Okay. Yes, I'm writing this down.
Okay, because my grandmother used to use the beet greens all the time in pasta and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
But I've got an idea. What if you cut off the beet greens, and you can even finely chop the stalks, okay? Put those aside for a moment. Wash them really well. Peel the beets and slice them paper thin,
okay. And
you're going to make a raw salad. Now, the next thing you're going to do is you're going to take a sweet pink grapefruit.
Okay, got that. We have plenty of that.
Oh, yeah, you probably have them grow in your backyard, you guys
exactly.
In Arizona. Okay, real sweet pink grapefruit. Take the sections out of it.
Uh-huh.
Get rid of the pit. So you've got these wedges of grapefruit.
Uh-huh.
And now we're going to do one of these, you know, she hoo-ha restaurant arrangement plates.
Uh-huh.
Okay? You're going to take the wedges of grapefruit and kind of arrange them in chunks on the plate. You're going to stand up the rounds of the beets.
Uh-huh.
You are going to wilt. Oops, wait a minute. Back up. You got to wilt the greens.
Okay.
Saute the greens in a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper. Just get them wilted. Put them on the plate. Then put the grapefruit wedges on top of that. Stand up the rounds of the beet.
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Drizzle that with balsamic vinegar.
Balsamic vinegar.
Coarse salt.
Uh-huh.
A little black pepper.
Uh-huh.
And then take a little olive oil and puree it with fresh chives. And drizzle around the edges.
Did you make this up at the top of your head?
Yeah, I did. Doesn't it sound good?
Genius.
I am so hungry for this thing. Oh, boy.
I can't wait to try this because we have all this fresh right now in Arizona. And, boy, isn't that a showpiece for a dinner party?
I have to say I'm cheating only because the combination of sweet grapefruit and beets is one that's been around a while.
Really? I've never heard of that.
But you know what's that idea of orange with beets?
Oh,
just
yes,
extend
right.
it a little bit. But try this. I think it'll be great. It'll be light. It'll be fresh. It'll be wonderful.
Oh, once again, totally came through.
We try. Thanks, Amy. Take care. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. If you remember this, things that are sweet like beets, and by the way, even parsnips, they really work beautifully with citrus fruit. So just file that away in the back of your mind, okay? You may not know this, but there's another Olympics out there. It's the World Cup of Baking. It's a competition for artisan bread bakers that happens every 3 years in Paris. And in 1999, the American team swept up all the medals and took the gold cup. Well, they're going for the gold again this year. And we have the team's coach, Craig Ponsford, on the line. Craig, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
So, Craig, tell me, honestly, how did the French react back in 1999 when you guys won?
They were very nice and generous, believe it or not. I tell people I always feel sorry for the team more than I did anything else because the French were very tough on their own team because they didn't believe they performed as well as they should have. But as far as we were concerned, they were very generous and nice.
Well, how does the competition work?
Basically, there's going to be 12 countries competing, and they set up 4 identical bakeries in Paris at a trade show, and 4 countries compete each day, and it's an 8-hour competition. There's 3 people per team, and there's 3 categories per team. Artistic, which is an artistic piece that needs to be performed in 8 hours in a 1-meter square space that's completely edible. Bread.
It's like a sculpture or something?
Yeah, it's a sculpture, and it's it can range from anything that's very classical, kind of traditional decorative stuff to very kind of, well, the Americans and the Japanese have taken it to a whole new level. It's very artistic, and you would never even believe that it's bread. It's very, very impressive.
So what are the other 2 categories?
The other 2 categories are bread. Every country has to make a baguette with 10 kilos of flour. And then you make 4 different varietals of bread that there are rules, but we kind of get to design the breads ourselves. And a total of 100 loaves of bread are made in that 8-hour period. And then viennoiserie, which is sweet yeasted risen dough, and that person has to do 5 300-gram pieces and 1,500-gram pieces in each category, and he has 5 categories, so 100 pieces total.
And all this has to be done in 8 hours?
That's correct.
So how do you train for this kind of thing?
Well, I've been putting these guys through the ringer for the last 7 or so months. We've been going to different facilities, using different equipment, different ingredients. The biggest part of the training, actually, is the development of the products. I mean, what we're trying to do is push the limits and really design new products with new flavors and new ideas. So that took the majority of the time, and then this last couple of months, we've been really doing a lot of choreographing, you know, getting them used to working in a very small space and making a lot of product in a short amount of time.
What's your greatest fear as the coach in all this? Because bread is an ornery critter. Bread's alive. I mean, it can do stuff you don't expect it to do.
Well, yeah, I think the three gentlemen that I've been training are going to be prepared for any kind of environmental aspect or even be able to deal with flowers they're not used to. They should be able to adjust rather quickly. Always a fear is the equipment that's put in these facilities is brand new, only been used maybe one day before we get there. So a fear is that the equipment isn't quite calibrated correctly or functioning right, and we compete on the first day, so that's one of the drawbacks. You know, the first day or two, they work out all the bugs, and by the third day, everything's running pretty well. You know, I'm also hoping that the judging is fair and honest, which I believe it's always has been in the past. I'm just being that we're the ones that hold the World Cup, they're going after us for sure, which is great, and I'm looking forward to a really tough competition, but I'm hoping it's a very, whoever the best team is wins.
So you don't want a rerun of the figure skating?
That's correct.
The figure skating competition.
No politics, I'm hoping.
Okay.
We're a little more relaxed as bakers. Hopefully we won't get into any kind of political stuff.
Well, Craig, good luck. We will be rooting for you.
Thank you very, very much.
Craig Ponsford is coach of the American Bread Bakers Guild team that will compete in the World Cup of Baking in Paris. Now, we're going to report the outcome of this year's competition. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Hey, thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with a bit of wisdom from Oscar Wilde. Something perhaps for the baking team to think about. In this world, there are only two tragedies. One is not getting what one wants, and the other is getting it. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And check out the Splendid Table store while you're at it. You're going to find it right there on the homepage. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.